Moreover, we may meet someone who is hagridden by that cruel and terrible fear of death which secretly afflicts so many who have been brought up in the old concepts of death and hell. Footnote. Hagridden definition, worried or tormented, as by a witch. It is a thing that very few people will confess spontaneously, and to meet someone who has escaped from that bondage may be like a light dawning in darkness to them. In our meditations upon our own deaths, do not let us concentrate so much upon the passing out as upon the life we are entering upon. Let us think joyously of the new hopes and activities that are opening up before us. We shall be free of the cumbrance of the body which, as our tune draws near, becomes increasingly a drag upon our activities. We shall rise up in the body of light, as it is called by the ancients. The burden of old age and ill health will have fallen from us, and we shall be vigorous of form and clear and buoyant in consciousness. In death we literally take on a new lease of life. We shall enter upon that new life with all the vigor and enthusiasm of youth, for we are indeed born again. Chapter 9. The Hidden Side of Death. The processes even of physical death are not nearly so simple as popular imagination believes, and it was a knowledge of the subtler aspects of death that gave root to many of the funeral practices of the ancients which we look upon today as pure superstition. With the passing of the last breath, the soul itself is gone and is no more concerned with its cast-off body than the chick with the eggshell. But those who remain are concerned with it, and certain of the subtler problems of the shock of bereavement are due to the little understood processes that are going on in the discarded clay. We have two tasks to perform before our service to our loved one is finished. We must see to it that dust returns to dust as swiftly and harmoniously as possible, giving rise to none of those happenings which may be termed the pathologies of death. And we ought to follow up the departing soul with the right kind of telepathic communication until it is safely established on the other side and will want to enter into its rest for a period. These two aspects of the last services to the departed are of very great importance, and we ought to give them our serious attention. Moreover, there is nothing that will help us in our grief so much as to feel that there is still something to be done for those who have gone over, and that we are not free to let ourselves go unreservedly in a paroxysm of emotion as we might do if we felt that we had nothing but ourselves to consider. 50. Let us study first what happens to the discarded and empty body immediately after the departure of the soul, for this will guide us in our attitude towards it and our manner of dealing with it. Firstly, the departure of the soul only means the death of the central nervous system. There is a great deal of organic life still left in the body itself. It does not die all in one piece. Indeed, for some days before death, or even longer, the soul may have been out of the body, floating at the end of the silver cord a few feet above the bed, looking like a sleeping ghost and clearly visible to any psychic. While this condition prevails, there is deep unconsciousness on all planes and no suffering. It is only when the silver cord is severed that the soul finally departs and actual death occurs. The sudden rally and return of consciousness at the end is caused by the soul, which recovers consciousness on its own plane as the end approaches, making a last effort to concentrate on the body, in order that the process known to occultists as the etching of the seed atom may take place effectually. This seed atom is a nucleus of force of the same type as that of the physical plane, which is retained by the soul throughout its evolution, and which plays an important part in the processes of rebirth. The term etching is, of course, metaphorical, and represents the tuning of this nucleus to a certain type of vibration and its impression with certain images. 51. If this has already been done, the soul is ripe for death, and the last rally may not take place. Therefore, the absence of this rally does not mean that the processes of death are not going on as they should. On the other hand, when violent death takes place, if the body is so shattered that death is instantaneous, no etching of the seed atom is possible. Therefore, it is held by esotericists that the soul immediately seeks rebirth, before the second death takes place, and equally rapidly passes out again, having merely assumed a physical body long enough to enable it to make its exit from life in due form. It has often been remarked by mothers and midwives that the newborn child, which has an extraordinary appearance of intelligence and maturity in its eyes, is not going to live. It is the eyes of an adult soul that they see looking at them, and all the service that soul requires at their hands is the rites of burial according to its faith. It is not meant to live, it is only meant to die adequately. It may seem that this inflicts a hardship on the mother who has made her great sacrifice to bring it into the world only to lose it, but if we examine the karmic record of the case, and no occultist would ever attempt to judge a matter in the light of a single incarnation, we shall find either that there is a karmic debt owing, which is settled in this way, or if no such debt can be traced, then karmic credit has been given. This karmic credit is a point that is often forgotten. Sometimes the lords of karma owe us a debt which entitles us to one of those sudden strokes of pure luck which we can explain by means of no hypothesis, which only takes account of one life. The Good Samaritan, the complete stranger who renders us a totally unexpected service, may be a soul for whom we have opened the gates of birth and death in a previous life. 52. Once the soul has safely withdrawn, however, there is an immediate change. Any sensitive person can feel the difference between the atmosphere of the chamber of death, however peaceful, and the atmosphere of the chamber of the dead. During life, a man is under the lordship of the archangel of his race and the savior of his religion, but after death this domination is withdrawn, or rather, it follows the soul and leaves the body to its own devices as being no longer of any concern. The vacant clay then passes under the domination of the regents of the elements, and the elemental force of earth, air, fire and water each withdraw that which belongs to them and restore it to its own kingdom. In this process they are assisted by a certain type of life, which belongs to the most primitive form of existence and which is fast passing out of manifestation. I refer to the unicellular organisms that live on dead matter, the saprophytic bacteria which cause decomposition. The parasitic bacteria which feed upon living tissues and cause disease are another matter. They belong to certain forms of life whose day is overpast and who, defying the law of evolution, refuse to withdraw from the physical plane. They are rebels against cosmic law, and advancing knowledge is gradually driving them out of manifestation. The curious feel off the death chamber and the fear that most people have of a dead body are caused by this opening of the gates of the elemental kingdoms. 53. The beings of the elements are present and active when organic matter has to be disintegrated and returned to its respective spheres. Sensitive people feel their presence, and because elementals belong to a very primitive form of life, find them disturbing. It is for this reason that it is not good for the living to remain in the immediate neighborhood of the dead. There are, however, four mighty archangels who are called the archangels of the elements because they rule the elemental kingdoms as overlords in the name of God. These are Raphael, Michael, Gabriel and Uriel, and they equate with the four evangelists of the Christian tradition. Hence the children's prayer. Four angels round my bed, two at the foot and two at the head. Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, guard the bed that I lie on. Every rite for the dead ought to commit the clay into the care of these four great spirits before the throne. When they are invoked it will be found that the somewhat sinister atmosphere sometimes felt in a death chamber will immediately lift and clear. The return to dust of the body, however, is but half the process of physical death, for there is another body, equally physical, equally mortal, which is called the etheric double. It might aptly be called the body of electricity, for it is an organized system of electromagnetic stresses, and it smashes every cell and fiber of the physical body lies like a bottle in a bottle rack. It transmits to every molecule of the body the vital force which keeps disintegration at bay and maintains the unstable compounds of organic matter in their elaborate and fugitive forms. It is the withdrawal of this etheric double which marks the critical moment of death when the breath is seen to pass. Embodied in it, the soul remains in an unconscious condition for a brief period, from a few hours to 3 days, if its tenancy of the etheric body is prolonged beyond this time, or if the soul wakes up to consciousness while still in the etheric double, one of the pathologies of death has occurred. It is this waking of the soul while still in its etheric double which, in popular phrase, causes its ghost to walk. Within the appointed time, however, unless something abnormal occurs, the magnetic forces of this body of electricity will have been exhausted, it will be like a battery that has run down, and the soul will slip out of its meshes and no longer have any link with matter. It is not this, however, that we call the second death, it is rather the second half of the physical death, and while it is going on, the soul is asleep in the deepest unconsciousness. It will now be seen why it is so unwise to try and get into touch with a soul immediately it has passed over, for we may wake it from its etheric sleep and cause it to walk. Do not let it be thought by this that the esotericist condemns communication with the departed, but there is a right and a wrong way of effecting this communication, and there are times when it may safely and helpfully be done, and times when it had better be left alone, and we need to know these things if we are to deal with death rightly. Our modern thought places adults in the same position in relation to the mysteries of death that children endure in relation to the mysteries of birth. There is a conspiracy of silence which confuses the issue and places us at a grave disadvantage in dealing with our problems. 55 in original book. Chapter 10, Purgatory. We have already told of the merciful work of the great anaesthetist, who causes a deep sleep to fall upon the soul as it passes out of the gates of the flesh. The etheric body fades and falls away from it unnoticed, and it sleeps on in that state of consciousness which occultists call the astral plane. But presently it begins to dream. The memories of its earth life are still present with it, though faint and far away, like the memories of early childhood. But it does not dream of these happenings as they appear to us who shared them. It reviews them instead from the point of view of its present state of existence. It is in the world of desire, and it sees them from the standpoint of fulfilled or frustrated desires. But the brain no longer clogging consciousness, the soul is not only conscious upon the plane of its present existence, but the higher consciousness is also awake and active. And all the time that this phantasmagoria of dream is going on, the higher self is holding up the mirror to consciousness and bidding the soul look therein upon its own image. All the time the inexorable spiritual standards are kept before its eyes. The soul, forced to contemplate these, undergoes a struggle severe in proportion to its deviation from the spiritual standards. Nothing explains these states so well as the terminology of analytical psychology. The soul is in the throes of a conflict between its higher and lower aspects. This conflict is subjective and expresses itself in the imagery of the astral dream, and the soul is said to be in purgatory. 58 For purgatory is simply the forced realization of the significance of our own misdeeds. Its scenery, so often described by saints and psychics, is such stuff as dreams are made of. The dreams of souls forced to face the truth. This scenery, therefore, is by no means idly fantastic, but has definite symbolic relationship to the problems of the soul, of evolution, and of the cosmic reactions. Every soul has its own personal symbolism, derived from the experiences of its own history, even as we find in the psychoanalysis of dreams. In addition to this, it has the symbolism of the types of its religious faith, which it shares with all the members of its faith. Therefore the hell of the Christian will differ in many ways from the hell of the Muslim. On the other hand, it will have much in common, because there are certain type symbols which are common to all sentient human beings, being formed out of their common human experience, such as the pain of burning and the torture of thirst. Each individual soul is taught by these dream pictures that sin brings inevitable suffering, for it is shown the consequences of its wickedness or folly and may not turn away its eyes. It feels in imagination as it would feel if it had actually come to the state which its dreams depict. Sisyphus the ambitious rolls his eternal stone up the hill and may not rest, Tantalus the drunkard sees the cup recede from his lips. Thus each learns the vanity of his weakness. 59. The initiate has never believed in the appalling doctrine of eternal punishment. No psychic has ever confirmed this belief, no spirit returned from beyond the grave has ever reported it. What is there any man could do in the brief spell between birth and death to deserve it? But every spirit reports purgatory and has a wholesome respect for it. But these are not the flames of eternal torment but the cleansing fires that purify the soul as gold is tried, in the furnace until all its dross is burned away and it is pure and precious. It is not maintained, however, that the dross of an evolution can all be burnt away in the purgation of a single death. Few souls are so pure and strong that they could endure so severe a trial without their fibers being disintegrated. Therefore we are shown no more at a single purgation than we can well bear and profit by. We are permitted to wipe out a certain proportion of our karma, and then come back to earth with the rest still bound about our neck, and it is this unexpiated karma that causes our sufferings in the next life. And so gradually, with what we realize while in purgatory and with what we make amends for while on earth, we compensate our karma and adjust the balance. Thus does the soul make its growth, but although purgatory is primarily a subjective experience, it is not wholly subjective. The vivid dreams and feelings of the souls going through this experience create a very definite atmosphere about them. On the astral plane there is no time and space as we understand them, but a mood is a place, and those who are in the same emotional state are drawn together. 60. Can we not readily understand how the atmosphere made by all the souls at present out of incarnation, who are struggling with thwarted hate or unsatiated lust, would mold the scenery of hell out of the plastic astral ethers? All those who hate, all those who lust, congregate together, and it is largely the cumulative atmosphere that they make between them which causes the abreaction of the higher type of soul. The soul that has possibilities of redemption. The minor transgression, which appears venial enough in ourselves, looks very different when we find ourselves in the midst of a sphere where innumerable souls are carrying it to all extremes and we have to live in its atmosphere. Indulgence in the sins of the flesh, which may not appear so bad when it is being done by a single person in an otherwise clean environment, will soon nauseate even its most hardened habitué when he is compelled to practice his chosen vice in company with thousands of others who are all doing exactly the same thing, and is not allowed to stop when he has had enough, because the irresistible momentum carries him on willy-nilly. This is the most effectual way to cure sins of the flesh, and the lords of karma make full use of it. If, however, a soul has largely risen above its weaknesses during life, or if it is not very deeply imbued with them, its visit to the purgatorial fiery whirlpool will be brief, for its struggle to resist the current will soon cause it to be thrown out upon the bank, free. None, however, may escape the experience of facing their own weaknesses in the company of those like-minded to themselves. No amount of masses and candles and prayers is going to spare them this. 61. We can, however, concentrate upon souls, a telepathic current which shall focus spiritual forces upon them and thus cause them to win to a realization and reaction more quickly. In brief, we can apply spiritual healing to the souls in purgatory. Many people endure great anxiety concerning the fate of some loved one who has died in sin and unrepentant. It may be a great comfort to them to know that spiritual healing forces can be applied just as effectually to souls in purgatory as absent treatment can be given to souls in incarnation. Let us always remember that if we can communicate telepathically during life, we shall have no difficulty in communicating telepathically after death. For if minds can communicate without material means while both are upon earth, the position will not be materially affected when one of the pair has no longer got any material means wherewith to communicate, but has to rely exclusively upon the mind. One of the occult disciplines consists in reviewing each night, evening, the events of the day in the reverse order, that is to say, from the evening to the morning. Although this may be a little confusing at first, for the mind naturally attempts to follow its habitual sequence of cause and effect, one soon becomes habituated to it and experiences no difficulty. There is a twofold reason for this operation. The first is to accustom the mind to work out of its normal sequence and so enable it to penetrate the veil of birth and recover memories of past incarnations, and the other is to keep the karmic debt within bounds. By abreacting each day any errors we may have made, we prevent our purgatorial debt from accumulating. 62. Of course, if we merely abreact them each day and repeat them again the next, we are not doing ourselves very much good, for although we may have neutralized that particular portion of karma, we are acquiring plenty more of an even more unpleasant nature, for we are making sure of a place for ourselves in die hell reserved for hypocrites. And anything more painful than the unmasking of a hypocrite to the depths of his selfish and cowardly soul, it is hard to imagine. The mills of God grind exceeding small, and not so slowly either, all things considered. Let us always bear in mind, however, that purgatory is neither punitive nor retributive, but essentially healing to the soul. The cautery of hellfire clears up the septic wounds that life has left us. There is clean healing after that burning. Let us therefore, during our lifetime, clear up all we can of those things we have done amiss, whether in wickedness, error, or weakness. If we can cure ourselves of our evil tendencies, hell will not have to teach us our lessons, for we shall have already learnt them. And finally, when our time comes to die, let us go over with courage, knowing that our evil dream will not last long, going to our purgatory as we would go to the dentist, knowing that it is going to be more or less painful, but not more than flesh and blood can bear and be none the worse for it. And let us, above all, realize that we are in skilled hands. Picture below left astral helpers are all the time working for helping those thought imprisoned in the lower astral levels. Chapter 11 The Heaven World. We hear a great deal about the heaven world in spiritualistic communications, and many people are repulsed by the idea, for they feel that everything is represented as being so material. They read of Raymond smoking cigars and drinking champagne and feel that heaven falls short of their expectations. Or again they read of a golden floor and perpetual harping, and feel that this would not appeal to them either. A rather higher type of heaven is described by the spirits, who tell us that the artist paints marvelous pictures upon illimitable canvas, or the scientist penetrates the secrets of nature by merely looking at them. Delightful as everything is made to sound, we feel instinctively that there is something wrong, for all this does not ring true. Moreover, we feel that we should be thoroughly bored even if it were true, for there is no pleasure in an age-long, effortless perfection. So much of our joy in achievement lies in the triumph of difficulties overcome. There can be no such joy in an effortless heaven. For many people, too, there could be no joy in a heaven that did not include their loved ones. Now what are we to say to all these contradictory statements which do violence to our deepest instincts? They cannot all be right. But nevertheless, are they all wrong? How are we to understand them? First of all, we must realize that heaven is a state of consciousness, not a place. Pure mind is independent of time and space, as we know by our dreams, whether the dream of sleep or the daydream. 64 We can fantasy ourselves to be in ancient Egypt or far Cathay, and for all the purposes of consciousness we are there for the moment. We see the sights, we hear the sounds of these times and places in proportion to the vividness of our imagination. When we are first dead, we are simply disembodied minds and obey the laws of dream consciousness. Purgatory is our dream of remorse and purification, and the heaven world is our wish fulfillment. Freud tells the story of the little boy whose ration of cherries was limited by a careful mother, and who on awakening next morning announced, "Herman has eaten all the cherries." His dream had fulfilled the ungratified wish of the previous day. So in the sleep of death, the dreams that come to us during our heaven world phase are wish fulfillments. But they are something more than the idle gratification of fancy. They arise from the deep brooding of the mind upon its helps and ideals. These may not seem to us very lofty, but they represent the phase of experience through which that particular soul is going in its evolution, and it may be necessary for that soul to go through the realization of its hopes in order to profit by the lesson. The Mohammedan heaven with its houris may not appeal to the Westerner, but it has been potent to send thousands of fanatical devotees to a sacrificial death in order that their faith might be spread among the infidels, and that faith has been a great force for good among tribes so primitive that they could not respond to a more sophisticated appeal. 65. We must not judge another man's heaven by our own standards. His heaven is his wish fulfillment, not ours. We must face the fact that the cat burglar's heaven would be full of easily climbed porches. When we call back the spirits of the departed to tell us of their experiences in the heaven world whither they have gone, we are listening to their account of their dreams in the sleep of death. It is only when we are fortunate enough to get hold of one of the souls that are freed from the wheel of birth and death and are continuing their beneficent work for humanity upon the inner planes instead of entering into their rest. In other words, it is only when we get into touch with our master, that we shall hear an account of the heaven world that shall give us a real understanding of its nature and the relation of its parts to the whole. The account which is given by a person recently passed over, is comparable to the account that is given of the working of a great hospital by one of the patients in its beds. He sees only a very small portion of the whole, and has no means of assessing significance. The account which is given by the guides, ministering spirit friends, and others whose task is to assist the departed, is equivalent to that which we might receive from the probationer nurses of the same hospital. It is not until we hear the doctors lecturing to the students that we begin to grasp the significance and scope of the great institution we are investigating. 66. Purgatory is a hospital for sick souls, where they are operated upon. The heaven world is first a convalescent home, and then a school. For some few it may also be a college. In the lower fields of heaven, so often described in communications from the inner planes, souls rest and recuperate, dreaming pleasant dreams meanwhile that soothe them and make them happy. But this phase, having fulfilled its purpose, passes off and gives place to the next. In order to understand the significance of these inter-incarnation phases, we must enter somewhat deeply into the philosophy of the subject. As we have already noted, heaven, and equally hell, are states of consciousness, not places. But if we realize the actual facts of the matter, we shall find that Earth is also a state of consciousness. Modern physics is showing conclusively that matter is simply a form of force which, owing to the fact that it is equilibrium, appears to us to be static. There is no such thing as dense matter as popularly understood. When you bark your shins over the coal scuttle, you are really falling over electrical resistances. Incarnation is the state of consciousness L which perceives these forms of force. Discarnation, or death, is the state of consciousness which no longer perceives them but has become subjective and is only aware of the content of its own consciousness. In death the gates of the senses are closed. Otherwise the man is unchanged. In fact we might say that viewed from the standpoint of the soul, death is simply the closing of the gates of the senses. Comment. But according to the spiritual science of the Danish wise man Orsier Martinus, 1890-1981, we do have similar spiritual senses/organs in the different bodies. RO.im. If a man's consciousness is entirely limited to the five physical senses, though such men are air, he is as much shut in with his own thoughts and as inaccessible as the sleeper lying oblivious upon a bed. 67. But does this sleep of death yield nothing but pleasant dreams and rest? No, it does much more than this. Anyone who is familiar with the practice of mental work and meditation knows how powerful is the concentrated brooding of the mind upon some spiritual ideal. The highlands of heaven are the mounts of meditation. The soul, thought forms and giving itself auto-suggestion. These processes play an important part in formulating the vehicles of embodiment when the time comes for it to reincarnate. The artist who dreams his dream of cosmic canvases is building faculty. On Earth the realization of his vision was limited by the skill of hand and eye. In the heaven world he is under no such limitations, and bodies forth his vision as he sees it. This trains faculty, and when he reincarnates, he will have gone some way towards building himself a physical vehicle in which hand and eye will cooperate with the inner vision and give it form. Life after life of effort, together with the intervening periods of meditation on the inner planes, gradually make the soul that which it wishes to be. If its wishes are unworthy or untrue, the regularly recurring spells of purgatory neutralize its efforts. Like Penelope's web, that which was woven by day is unpicked by night. Those things which in our earth life we have realized but failed to attain are achieved in heaven. 68. This subjective achievement builds faculty and we return to incarnation with the power to achieve latent in us,